You have to find the old original, the first years of the Dawn. We used to write articles for the children. You went by the name of Uncle F. Uncle F. And he had some very beautiful stories for children. But he didn't last very long.
What kind of stories did he tell?
Bible stories. But he made them so real.
Well, Peter,
on a child's level, you know. They were really, everybody read them. It wasn't only children. Do you remember the story?
You want me to tell you my story?
Mm-hmm.
That comes natural to you.
Put them down on paper, then
they
won't be able to tell
them anymore. No, they won't be on paper, they'll be on tape.
That's
the original.
Oh, my. That big Greek.
Can I get you some tea?
Oh, yeah.
Could I?
I did get you one.
No, that's Tim.
This one.
Can I get you one?
She went for it.
Tell you what you do.
Right.
I'll tell you my stories, and you'll write a book. And you write the book, and then you'll share the proceeds.
Okay.
And he said, you worked at the Bible House. I said, I did. Because evidently, he talked to somebody that knew my history. He says, well, if you work at the Bible House, you'll live. And you're still in the same opinion. He says, I don't want to see you.
I can't hurt anything to put him on the mailing list.
No, I'll send him a copy of that booklet. Anyhow, at the time, when I worked at the Bible House, under Judge Rutherford, and it was some of the most ruthless experiences. Underhanded and ruthless. We had that every morning. That was, of course, Brother Russell's practice. At breakfast, a question meeting. They discussed the text. They read the manna text, and they discussed the manna text. At noon, Monday noon, Saturdays, the whole family, or all of the family that were elders, would scatter all over the eastern United States to speak on Sunday. There were probably 200 of us left, not us, because I wasn't an elder then, I wasn't even a deacon. But when they come back on Monday noon, they reported of their activities, where they were, how many attended the meetings, how many meetings, and so on, the interest. We used to have this is a story for your book. We used to have an old brother named Edward. He was really old, and in his younger days, he was a call porter, and he used to call porter on a donkey in Denver, or not in Denver, but in Idaho, or
Colorado.
And he rode his donkey up to where her mother, real mother, was confined at the Percolar, Pike's Peak. Yeah, he rode his donkey up to Pike's Peak to visit Sister Dickerson. But this was a practice. Every Monday, Brother Edwards, he had a little goatee. I wasn't ready yesterday, and we had a meeting. We had two wonderful meetings, one in the morning at 10 o'clock, and I gave a talk, and in the afternoon I gave another talk, and it was a wonderful talk. And his little good tea was good. We had a lot of fun with it.
Never mind on Brother Edwards. Brother Edwards. He was about the only visitor Mother had during the week, because Dad could only go out there weekends. That's all they knew to do for TV, you know, take them off the mom. We had a tent house,
was green mainly, and was filled up about halfway. He would come up with his little donkey with his books on the donkey, pick wildflowers all the way up for her. Just as whether as long as he's there till it started to get dark, and then go on down again.
I started to tell about ruthlessness. The all of the noon meetings or meals were question meetings, and the evening meeting meal was a question meeting. There was a youngster about the, Glenn's age. He'd been there, I guess, for a year, and I really don't know where he came from. But Judge Rutherford asked him a question, and he answered it. Evidently, I don't remember the question, I remember the action. Not to the judge's satisfaction. It's now, he says, 12 o'clock, 12:15. Before 2 o'clock, he says, you're leaving this place. Now, where would the boy go? We're only getting $10-$15 a month. Where would they go? But no matter. Before 2 o'clock, you're leaving this place. And the boy had to leave. We were after we left the society, 29, 30, 31, there was a convention in Brooklyn, and we were attending it. When we left here, it was Labor Day. When we left here, Mirza's brother had come to Wilmington on a vacation from the Watchtower, the headquarters, with a German girl. And while they were here, they got married. That week, the Watchtower was shut down, and everybody was out on vacation. Labor Day was the last day of their vacation. So Malin, her brother, and his wife now, Ellie, had gone back a little ahead of time, a day ahead of time, and they were either in her room or his room. And had a electric hot plate, they call it, and they were warming some spaghetti to eat. And Judge Rutherford opened the door and walked in. No knock nor anything. He said, and again, you are leaving now, today. So I was sitting in the meeting, listening to some speaker, when one of the ushers patted me on the back, because somebody went to see you at the door. And it was Malin. This is what happened to us. What are we going to do now? So I went to Sister Hudgens. She had an apartment that she was renting out, not far from the meeting place, and talked to her. Just tell him to wait till after the meeting, I'll see him. So she took him in and kept him there for about a week, I guess. But they had to leave. No mercy of any kind. And in this book, in this pamphlet that they send out, that Dolores, I gave to Dolores to read, and now I gave it to Kenneth. There is a trial, whether it's a judicial trial or whether it's a church trial, I'm not for sure. Did you find out what it was? What kind of trial was it that Covington was?
I think that was a church trial.
A church trial. I thought it was a church trial.
One of the brothers, one of them had taken them to court and won a $15,000 award because...
Well, that was some
year.
Moyle.
You know Edna Moyle.
Edna Moyle?
You know Edna Moyle?
Yeah,
that's the name.
Her husband's father won that case. You know Brother Moyle. But the trouble is...
The violation of their rights or something.
To sue the society, to sue your brethren and get the $15,000. He got out of the truth too after a while, but all the way. It didn't do him any good, in other words. But anyhow, his son has joined some Jewish congregation now. I don't know what he left the truth.
Father has to sue.
But in... in this booklet, the questions and answers, and the gist of it was, you have to believe what the watchtower tells and be obedient to what the watchtower dictates or else. And Covington says, yes or else. Or word to that effect.
One point that they made was that only the part of the church that's in Brooklyn is able to interpret scripture.
Yeah.
Even if you claim to be, even if you're a part of the so many 10,000 that they think that are left of the church, if you're not in Brooklyn, you can't interpret scripture.
the authority of the church, the church authority, wherever they are, self-appointed, self-perpetuating group. Their word is the law. And if you don't accept it, out.
Yep. I'd leave it just as fast as I did the other part.
How?
I'd leave it just as fast as I did the other part.
I would too. I would too.
We have to move to Brooklyn so we can drink a bottle of beer.
Well, I like you.
We have a nice life.
You can believe anything you want. Now, of course, this isn't the first time that I went over the first volume. I don't know how many times I went over it. But it's been a very, very, very precious privilege to lead the first volume study in this group over these many years. My first attraction, that is my first real interest in the first volume, was in the third chapter where it says the Bible, I forget the name of the chapter now, but it has to do with the Revelation. The second chapter is the existence of a creator.
The Bible as a divine revelation?
That's the second chapter. No, it's a later chapter. He goes over the law very briefly, but the few fragments of the law that he brings to, that I saw in the first volume, of course, excited me because it made such a distinction between the laws that we have today and the laws of God. That was the first. If I would choose for my simple mind the best chapter of the book, it would be Natures Separate and Distinct. I say it's simple. But there my mind was forced to accept the idea that natures can't be mixed, that they're separate and distinct and they'll stay that way. The only changes that are to be made are those who will be changed from one nature to another, the way your word was changed from a higher nature to a lower, and then back to a much higher. It's a chapter that explained a lot of things to me, and it's simple. And the Apostle Paul calls the gospel simple. He calls it the simplicity of the gospel. He didn't want to disturb the simplicity of the gospel. It's only when we get into, we think the deeper things, we call them deeper things, where we can't agree and we get confused and we confuse everybody else. So that's all I have to say. The divine plan of the ages revealed to me that God has a law that's far superior to the laws under which we are living today, and that someday it's going to be enforced worldwide. That natures can be mixed, and each nature is separate and distinct and propagates its own kind. And I think that that carries from the inanimate material that we have. God didn't allow any mixture of anything. No mixture, when we say gold, it's got to be gold. If it's silver, it's got to be silver. The scriptures use the term brass, but that's not correct. It should be copper. He never allowed any mixture of copper and tin to make brass or bronze. He never allowed the seeds to be planted close to each other so that it would mix. He wouldn't even allow the mixture of clothes. A woolen garment must be wool throughout. A cotton garment had to be cotton throughout. A linen garment had to be linen throughout. No mixtures. And it carries that. And I think it's one of the most important things that we have to learn. And then we are safe in the machinations of the adversary and the fallen angels that pretend to talk as though they were our grandparents. We are safe from that. And that's only one aspect, but throughout my thinking, that chapter, nature's separate and distinct and can't be mixed. It's the crowning, to me, was the crowning work of the Russian. Not that it was his invention, but at least the what I wrote about the Russian is that he taught me the scriptures. He taught me to understand the scriptures. In this chapter, the concluding thoughts, he says, we learn this and we learn that, but questions will arise, they are arising, but if you stick to the scriptures, you'll find the answers. The only time that you won't find any answers are things that are beyond us, that especially things that are not fulfilled, that are still future, and we are trying to push them ahead, and to understand them, then it's very difficult to understand. In due time, we will understand. That's all we have to say. Thank you for your
attention. Well, I have to admit that the first volume has been a wonderful help to me. I did believe in God, but I didn't know that he was the kind of a God that he is. I thought that I thought when you died you were still somewhere in the form, and if you had been dead on the earth, you were being punished. I did have that idea. And until I was a very mature woman, if you recall it, and not until I came in the truth, I didn't know any different. So I have to admit that I'm very thankful for the first volume and the volumes that I've been through with the different brethren. I still don't understand everything, but I do have a great appreciation for what I do.
That's cruel. He don't like to see, he wouldn't like to see it burn forever and ever. So he wouldn't, he'd just destroy it. I always believe that. And Norris, I want one more question. If this wasn't the Word of God, this book wouldn't have survived all these generations. There hadn't been another book that has survived this book.
Thank you. Yeah, I would like to say that, in addition to what I've already said, it's true that the Bible has been around for a long time, and I'm sure it always will be, but it was these volumes that I think helped all of us to find out what was in this Bible and what it meant. And I believe also, like the introduction here to the 1 Corinthians, the 3rd chapter, Jesus Christ is the only foundation. How many times I've sung that in church without a real meaning of a relationship between Jesus and God. I knew that Jesus came in the form of man, but like Sister Joan said, I didn't know that God had created him.
The 3rd chapter, that is, he had according to a plan of the ages. And it tells me that God is not going about his work in a haphazard manner. The way generally accepted, God is trying to save as many as he can from the clutches of the devil. But the devil gets the most of the men out. Now, when you stop and think of it, that's ridiculous. There's an argument, God and devil, and the devil's going to get the best of it? You're slightly touched when we say that. But according to a plan of the ages, and each age has its own work to perform, and each age comes to an end and introduces another, progressive, nothing that's beautiful. And God is not trying, he's doing.
I think there, to add to a little bit that I've said, I think there were two things that really struck me or are meaningful to me. Certainly there are more than that. We can go through each one of the studies and find many things that are important to us. But I think the harmony of the scripture and learning that you had to study from Genesis to Revelation on a particular subject, that was very meaningful and has helped in, of course, all the subsequent studies. And then, aside from that, I think the ransom and restitution has the most meaning for me. And of course, it is the basis, we know. And we've talked to so many. Well, so many. It makes it sound like we're out every day on the street corners, and we're not. But the ones who we have talked to, who don't have that understanding, when you talk about the ransom and what it really means, of course you can't start talking about that without getting into other things. But it all comes back. And with that ransom and the promise of restitution, it does away with purgatory. It does away with torment, eternal torment, because things are going to be restored to what they were. It's a restanding, a restoration. And that, that's beautiful to me. And I do thrill in it. I don't probably tell it as often as I should, but with the Lord's help, that'll come along too. Anyone else? Doris, did you have anything further to say?
Well, Armstrong,
yes.
In that ability wise, the effect, if you allow it, you don't have to allow it, but if you allow it, the ideas that the plan of God, the Bible presents to us, it makes a lot, or it makes my life, and I hope it makes all your lives, much peaceful. We have arguments with each other, especially with my wife, but on the whole, with strangers, with others, it should give us an appreciation of the fall, that they all have fallen. Some of them fell longer distances than others. Some were damaged in the fall more than others. And we should make allowances. In other words, even if they slap you in the face, consider the source. Your profile is slightly insane. They're really glad that. People do this and receive that it's unjust, but who expects just things from imperfect human beings? You can't expect that. So we expect the world the way it is. We're trying to help if we can, and most of the time we can, but it gives us an attitude, a viewpoint of life and of man that can't be beat. Otherwise, you're fighting all the time.
Yeah. I must say this, but I'll say it, but before I come to truth, this is selfish of me. I had one consolation, that everybody died the same way. There was no special ones that died specially.
We were following up. They have names that go back as far as 60 and 61. And I said, how do you expect to find these people same place? Oh, we send them a newsletter every month. And if they're gone, if they've moved, then the postman, post office tells you, you know, that they're not there anymore. So we found them all, but there were four in the car, and they go off to get something else around the corner, and while they were gone, if we finished, it was quite an eye-opener to me. The more I think of him, the more I realize that the witness of the Lord's Word has gone out even from the JWs, and his mind, reasoning on it, sees the difference. He was very pleasant. I imagine he was 55 or 60. He had, and in what way? Well, he says, I think Adam is going to come back. I said, good. So then we shook hands on that. I says, you know, if he doesn't, you won't either. He says, you know, I kind of think that's right. Because if you reason it out, he says, the way they tell it, Adam's had his chance and he won't come back. But I can't see how that's any ransom. So people are not so dumb. And minds work from the scriptures, no matter where they get it. And he said he was some kind of a Methodist, but he still believed in the ransom, and he thought it worked and that Adam would come back. But,
The mind of a person, but I can't locate it. It's in Corinthians. I forget now where it is. The apostle in the epistle tells us that while he gesture was to leave the world, he didn't ask, he said that. He said, I'm not asking you to just walk out. And in one of my talks, I mentioned that, and I made the idea that you're not supposed to go to a monastery. But we do that. We do that, if some of the friends are doing that, just that. They abandon everything. They don't know anything that's happening in the world. They don't know anything that's happening in Methodism or Baptism or any other way, any other place. And so we conclude that there's nobody, no Christians anywhere but ourselves. And that's the most damaging, excuse me, the church. I don't know if there are other churches. I think the Episcopalian church practices to some extent. But in the Catholic Church, both in the Greek and the Roman, they used to go in the dungeon. And they were the dungeon. Well, you have nobody to... You can't sit in the desert unless you do something foolish for yourself. Well, they used to climb, they build a pillar and climb the pillar and sit in the pillar the rest of their lives. But then somebody had to take food to them. Those are the ridiculous extremes that they went to. They have monasteries, they go into a monastery only by themselves. And anyhow, it's a long story. If you attend that Bible study, oh yes, but there was a Bible study. They had the sign, but nobody read.
So, not even his wife?
Not even his wife. Even the meetings that he attended, his wife didn't come to the meeting.
So,
the first night, he said, what are we going to study? Let's study John, the Gospel of John. And in the first verse, we had after four or five meetings, he realized that we had more to teach him than he could teach us. He could sign down and everything.
He said he would share with us. He said it so much.
It's been recent, Glenn.
I've been waiting.
That's what they call them nowadays.
Sharing groups.
His parents go to one on Wednesday night at St. Mark's. It's called sharing group.
She goes to the
Maybe they're getting away from Bible study.
Women's Society.
Because they don't study the Bible.
Had the Bible open to the passage where it says that they'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks when he took his oath of office. There was something else in that passage too that struck me odd the other day when I was reading it, thinking about Nixon. I have to look that up and see where it was.
Here's Bob.
No, I've got a note in my pocket. He was thinking that the Lord's kingdom might be established in this nation.
Oh yeah.
You know, because he does have religion.
Well, they gave up Israel, you know, all the other.
Who did?
The Jehovah's Witnesses.
She's talking about Nixon.
She's talking about Nixon.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Nixon was a Quaker, supposedly.
Nixon. Oh, Nixon.
Snicker Nixon.
Well, you know, I used to boil when people used to call him that.
Must have been about 1916. I was serving my apprenticeship as an electrician. I had been in this country since 1911. My English was still pretty badly broken. And I was at the shop early in the morning, and a brand new man, very big fella, apparently Polish descent, came in the shop and looked around, never said a word. Turned out he got on the company's delivery truck and drove away. I was told that he was our new truck driver. We didn't live too far away from the shop, so at noon I used to go to our home within three blocks from the shop and had some lunch. And then about 1:15, on my way back, I heard behind me a voice saying, "Yay, gimme!" Well, the Greeks and the Italians were often called that, and we didn't like it at all. So I stopped. That was a small fella. Compared to him, he probably would make three of me in weight, and probably a foot higher than I was, taller. So he came up to me. I said, "Why did you call me Guinea?" He said, "You do that again and I'm going to heave a hammer at your head that you'll never forget if you live through. You understand that? Don't ever call me that again." The man acted surprised. He says, "What are you mad about?" He says, "I didn't call you Guinea. I came in the shop this morning and I saw you there, and walking behind you, I recognized you were going to the same place I was going. I didn't know your name, so I hollered, "Hey, Jimmy!" So I had to apologize. God says, "Excuse me, I thought you called me Jimmy. But if you say that you called me Jimmy," I says, "please excuse me." Then he said, "Why would you get mad?" He says, "Because anybody called you Guinea. Somebody called me a Greek the other day and I didn't get mad." And of course he didn't know I was a Greek. That's the story.
What's that story about your mother when you had mice in the house?
What?
Remember he exercised the house or something?
No, some other time. I don't know what you mean now. Yeah. My grandmother.
Oh, was it your grandmother?
Yeah, my grandmother was pestered, was bothered with mice in the house. So she called in the priest to exorcise the rats from the house. So the priest came with a bucket of holy water. He chanted and he prayed and he spread the sprinkled holy water all over the house, collected his money, and on his way out, he says, "Mrs., I did all I could, but I was like a little cat for good measure." That's the second story.
And why is it, funny for one thing for your grandmother to call a priest expecting to get mice out of the house? You know, why do we laugh at that?
Well, they believed that the priest could do anything, and not what the priest did, but what he said, and the fact that he was a representative of God, the citation of the Mass and the sprinkling of holy water would keep the mice away. That was the expectation. And people believe that. Well, Mirza had a similar experience with a Presbyterian minister in Chesapeake City. It's funny, religious as the people are, most of their jokes are about priests.
Oh, really?
A teacher that, he was a rascal, he was an alcoholic. The 6th, 7th, and 8th grades were taught in two rooms in the churchyard, just opposite, across the yard from the church, a big building. The upstairs floors were used for girls' schools. The ground floor was used for the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, taught by two teachers. Of course, there were very few pupils. By the time they got to the 6th grade, they were pretty near thinned out, because we had no compulsory education. We were really living under Turks. They didn't care whether the Greeks knew anything or not. Mm-hmm. that in fact the Turks are in responsibility for all domestic family affairs, troubles, education and religion were left to the church. The Turks kept their hands off of it. If anything happened, it's your baby, not ours. But anyhow, this teacher taught us catechism, and when he, at lunchtime, he got a little too much to drink, he used to say things that if he was sane, he was normal, he wouldn't do it. And all those things, of course, are in my mind, and they serve their purpose. They serve the purpose of seeing through. When I learned about the truth, I could see easier through the machination of the schemes of the clergy, of the priesthood. We had, I have pictures, not pictures, but I have pictures that I used to illustrate it. There was across the yard, and the church was a big building. Probably there were 4,000 or 5,000 people could stand in it. And we had no seats. We were in the lobby seat. Along the wall, they had lean-tos, where only the old man could not sit, but stand there and rest or support themselves standing up. On the, I don't know what you'd call it, the L, reverted to V, and the church, and right in the middle of it was a marble plate, and the figure on it was the Archangel Michael. And the church was dedicated to Archangel. Do you hear me tell the story?
Yeah,
the story.
No, go ahead, tell it.
Anyhow, the teacher said, "What is this? You see that marble up there?"
Yeah.
What's the figure on it? The figure is the Archangel Michael. That's right, he said. You know where that marble came from? No. You know that if you go down, if you follow the creek that runs, the stream that runs through the town, through the village, or say a half hour walk downstream, you come to the ruins of an old city? Yes, that city was destroyed by an earthquake. Yeah, you know that. Well, in that city, they used to have a temple, and the temple was dedicated to Apollo, the god Apollo. Yes, whatever. Well, he says, that figure over there on the marble used to be Apollo in that other temple. Well, what difference does it make?
The skull?
The skull was a doctor that was a native of another village. I guess you would call it our county seat, Colony. And evidently he was a good doctor, and for somehow or other he did minister to the Sultan of Turkey. And evidently he did a good job, and the Sultan, besides paying him, gave him another privilege, that any property that was his, or in his name, registered in his name, would never be confiscated by the government. So, villagers, instead of leaving their property, the home or the farm or a grove of olives or anything that they possessed, instead of letting it go to the family, to their descendants, and risking the sometime confiscation by the government, donated the property to the church and to the two monasteries, one for men and one for women, that this doctor had set up, established before he died. And the two monasteries were pretty well to do. In fact, they owned so much of the ground on the island that we couldn't make a living anymore. We had to leave the country, or leave the island, go as far as the United States. Some of us came to the United States, some went to Argentina, my brother migrated to Khartoum in the Sudan and worked there for a while to make a living. And because of the monasteries were prosperous, evidently their contribution to the church, to the patriarchate in Constantinople, must have been considerable. And then suddenly a representative of the patriarchate came to the island and wanted to dig up the bones of Dr. So-and-so. Well, they showed him where the his grave was, and he had it dug up. And somehow or other, what he had to do with it, we don't know. But the odor of the decayed now bones was something out of this world. Whether he sprinkled holy water or rose water or whatever he sprinkled on them, it was evident that he was a saint. Otherwise his bones wouldn't smell that good. So he was canonized, he was made a saint, Saint Ignatius. And they had the skull, they placed it, made a tube box, and put it in, and the top piece was fitting, or acted as a mask, and you could see where the nose was, or the mouth, and the eyes, and so on. So every year at Epiphany Day, which must be around the 13th of January, sometime about that, the 6th or the 13th, somewhere there, they used to have a procession of this relic from the monastery to our village. And they set it up in the church. The villagers would go through and line up and prostrate themselves, cross themselves, and kiss this silver covered skull. Then we had a terrific epidemic of smallpox and wondered how it spread so fast and how to well.
Poverty. In Greece.
Poverty.
Well, then you thought that you'd be able to do better here in America than in Greece.
Oh, no doubt about that. Because there's nothing, we had nothing, no factories there.
Right.
The only mills that they had were flour mills and all of the fixed coal from Dollars had, but that provided labor. So we had something to eat, but just hungry. So he pulled out the dish of beans. Well, that's what they had in Greece. They didn't have didn't live on them, but most of our diet was beans. And here in the United States, and eat beans again. But in the afternoon, then we began to come home from work. It turned out there were, let's see, how many were we? 18 men living in a six-room house.
No woman.
They had to take care of it themselves. No electricity, no gas, no, only one tap of water, no bath. When we went to bed that night, my father and two of my mother's sister's husbands, and the husband of my mother's sister, and my father and I were in one room. My father and another, one of my uncles, were sleeping in the same bed, and I was sleeping in between them. In the winter, they thought they took pity on me, and they bought a coal stove and put it in this bedroom in order to keep me warm at night. It was the next door house was torn down to make room for a railroad siding to serve the Reuben Kenzie factory, which was right back of us. And with that house gone, there were holes in the walls, especially around the roof, where birds would come in the room. And in the winter, of course, wind and snow. And that's what they were trying to save me from. But the first night when we had this stove, we all slept there. In the morning, when they started to get up, get ready to go to work, one after the other toppled over.
What toppled over?
The people, the men, my uncles.
Right.
Yeah, because of the carbon dioxide in the room. I remember we paid $11 a month rent. So each of us were paying about 60, 75 cents a piece a month. That's how they saved money.
Let's see.
Yeah. Then, don't be shocked. There are people living like that today in the United States, especially among the color.
Probably more the Puerto Ricans.
Huh?
Probably a lot of Puerto Ricans today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Especially those. They're sort of the new immigrants.
Yeah. We aren't. We are an affluent nation. Not all of us are affluent.
live on, be somewhere, a kitchen where they distribute soup. You go get some soup. That's what you really eat. I met a Methodist preacher in canvassing. And she tried to discourage the woman from accepting the books Mercer was delivering, a set of studies. And the woman insisted that she was going to buy the books no matter what he said. So when Mercer left the house, he met the gentleman on the street. And he started an argument with him. Mercer said, "Now, mister," said, "you know you don't believe that." "I know," he said, "but my bread is not buttered on that side."
"Isn't a joke, honey?"
"Yes, it is."
"I think that's a joke."
"What?"
"He thinks
that doesn't
that's
have
funny.
To be. Maybe I can use it later on for this other thing I have to put together."
"I'm going to make some hot chocolate. You better come along
okay.
down.
Let me whistle. Let them down.
I'm not going to come up."
Sure, the food. the big loss of the country was the territory that they got to occupy. And we don't find that communication today. We trust to follow the fact that the war got to be 3 to 1. 3 men are serving to supply the one soldier that's back in the fight. But we lost all that, and I think we lost considerable of the world, the responsibilities and the trials of an army. But that of course up to the individual, and it's needed to individuals to respond. Thank you.
Between the stand that JWs take and ours is this, that our brethren take any service that is given. If you get your CO rating, they will say you have to serve in such and such a hospital, or you teach such and such a school. Some of the brethren taught undeveloped children and things like that, and they did that for 2 years, and they worked in hospitals, and they worked as guinea pigs for them, tried out food limitations for Air Force and all kinds of things.
anything that the government set them to do other than fighting.
Thank you.
Well, on the Mars's question, we realize the Lord has returned and has started his kingdom, but the world as such doesn't realize that. The scriptures say our citizenship is in heaven, not here. So what we have to look at from the standpoint that until the world recognizes and accepts the Lord's kingdom, still the powers that be are here and they're ruling. But whether God's permitting them to do it until the end, which he is, he uses them. I think we could read that Timothy passage that Glenn spoke of. We didn't read it.
Okay. Well, he's reigning. If he's reigning, he's a king. If he's a king and reigning, he's in control. And we certainly would not want to say, I wouldn't want to say that I ever believed that the Lord was not in complete control. In other words, the things that are happening because he is either making them happen or permitting them to happen. Now, if the president is still in power in the United States, I look at it, or the governing authorities, let's put it that way, I look at it that in God's plan with Jesus as king,
he's permitting.
They're still here. And
well, I think with us that it's well to watch. We know that things are changing rapidly all over the world, and the effect of the Lord's presence is being felt everywhere. In the last few years, we've seen that nothing can happen, not even overnight, that it isn't broadcast all over the world. Nothing is hid. And all these forces are surely under the Lord's power. It's interesting to watch. I'm not especially interested in politics, except to watch what will happen with the change of power, if it changed to some other kind of power than what we've had lately. But I think that all these forces are working together for the melting pot. We know that all the elements will melt with fervent heat, and that when you see it start, why, you only feel nearer to the kingdom. But I think this is very important to remember, as Rochelle says, that the object is that we may lead a quiet in life and fulfill our own destiny and make our calling and election sure. Whether we can always expect to do it with fair sailing, I doubt.
Years ago, it's nothing new, and then that is for me. How did paganism get in the church? And those fellows that did it, they were Greek scholars, students of Plato and Aristotle. It was easy.
Slava Greek.
We had a girl, a Polish girl from Detroit, and she was working with us, a nice, good worker, and the Polish girls were the workers, not that the others weren't working, but they'd do anything. Anyhow, her people sold their home in Detroit and bought a farm near Syracuse, New York. So Isabel come to me. I was the boss then. She says, I want some time off. So I want to go see my folks on the farm. I says, go ahead. To make it all the trimmings. She says, who's going to take me to the station?
Well, I didn't know.
Brother Kruppel, who was a truck driver, drove the truck for the dawn. Oh, I'll take you, Isabel.
Oh, will you? I'll give you a tip if you do.
He liked us.
Anyhow, she got to Syracuse. She came back about noon. And we were all eating just like this. Brother Bright was sitting, Mirza on my on one side of me, Sister Galbraith on the other side, and Brother Bright next to her. Isabel came in, and the only seat that was empty was one right across the table from his sister down, and she started to tell us what they found, what she found on the farm. Oh, they have a tractor, and they have, oh, this, and they have two horses. The name of one is Pete, and the other one is Maud. And then she, but you know, he says, I never could tell the difference. And then he says, how do you tell the difference?
At the dinner table, yeah.
Everybody was struck dumb, you know, nobody like paid attention. After a while, Brother Bright, he was the oldest. He says, Isabel, he says, they look at their teeth.
Straight face, dude. You went through the floor.
That was funny the first time you told that.
He laughs at his own story.
Awesome.
No matter how many times it makes it funny.
It tasted good.
You got a problem?
Yeah.
You didn't have your dinner, huh?
Oh, but I did.
You said you had trouble. Now stop it.
I've gotten so lazy.
Prepare me and write it up.
You had your recorder on.
Faith in what?
In
Christian or Western without knowing that there's a God?
Says without faith it's impossible to please him. We knew a person close by us. He's no longer living, but he was a representative or something. He was a member of our Methodist church where we went. And in calling on him for either a pledge or something, he let them know that, he was supposed to be a member of church. He was a public figure, but don't come to him for anything. It was just his name was on the roll, so he could say he was a member of church. Convenience for him.
I see you know some stories too. I come to that. Stories are useful. They
parables.
Edify.
They're parables.
Terrible.
Parables.
I thought you said terrible.
No, I wasn't there.
Okay.
Okay. Are we born Christian?
The Empire State, and the different companies that built their towers there. He says, where I come from, the steeples meant a church. He says, you are worshiping the prophet system, the one. And that's true. That's true. We made idols of that. And that's the way we're living, but we must be transformed. I know there's a little story. Friends, actually, this actually happened. You remember the days? You're all too young to remember. There was a splurge worse than it is today in Florida. Florida land prices were just zooming. And the friend, I'm going down there and buy land and make a million dollars. Then I'll show the Lord how much I can give them. You know what happened? The prices collapsed. And they lost the money. And they lost the truth too. And the friends, it's not, but the Lord takes our wishes, our intent, as Lois pointed out, what we desire to do. There's another brother was giving a talk in Pittsburgh. He says, we got a dime. We put it in our hand and we look at the dime and what am I going to do with the dime? What will the Lord do with the dime? So he says, we go into a soda fountain and get a soda and we get a bellyache. Then we wonder.
Could Tom, we just maybe briefly summarize why?
To say Chester. And somebody in Chester told him, now there is a sister in Wilmington, and called her name. If that didn't happen between Chester. I'm using them because you know Chester and Wilmington. But Brother Magnuson was born. Now when you go to Wilmington, there's a sister there that hasn't symbolized the consecration. And she'll ask you whether she should or not. So Brother Magnuson was prepared. He came down and the sister, after his talk, he said, Brother Magnuson, is it necessary, should I symbolize my consecration? Magnuson said, oh, no, sister. Only the dead are buried. In other words, unless you are dead as Christ, you need to be buried. And that's the answer to Michelle's question. Unless we are willing to die with Christ. Romans 6. Janet? The early verses.
3-5.
Thank you.
Do not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus have been baptized into this death. Therefore we have been buried with him through baptism into death, in order that as Christ is raised from the dead, through the
fly, he says, in this world, the blood of that fly would be just as efficacious as the blood of Christ. That is, the blood of Christ has no more efficacy than the blood of this fly. Do you think he ever walked out in here to go speaking? Not under Brother Osmond. Not under Brother Osmond. That's the extreme. That's the extreme.
Brother Peter, that's in 1 John 2.
You can't go. To the second or third soul, you must step to the first soul. And that's the first step. And unless we take that first step, there is a possibility we'll never take the next one. But the Lord comes to us, if we take the first, he'll show us the second, and we'll take the step. After we take the second, he'll show us the third, until we get across. But you must start. You must take the first step.
Well, after all, that's what the Lord said first.
That's what baptism is like.
Christianity will affect, will bring about. Even though it caused your own death, to see the travail of your soul, to be satisfied.
Right, that's humility, if you admit that you're good when you are. It's pride when you say you're good when you're not.
Didn't Jesus say things like that?
Yeah, we can't say that.
I know, yeah. Right. He said things that...
He says, learn of me, for I am meek. If I say that, right away, he says, look at this braggart, right? It's true.
We're managing the work here.
What's
and, I resigned, and I suggested that they appoint Brother Mason. So they did. And they found fault with Brother Mason. And we went to a meeting. Brother Greer was chairman that night. He said that Sister Ledley was secretary. The secretary says, I have a letter from the Watchtower. So she read the letter. The letter read that Brother Mason is being displaced, and Brother Dickerson appointed to take his place. And they had the words, unfaithful servant, in the letter, circled with red ink. Brother Mason was sitting next to me, and another brother, Brother Rudder, was sitting nearby. Mason showed me the letter and showed me the red mark. Put their darn fingers off our business. That you're satisfied with Brother Mason's work, and we're very happy to have him as our director. That Brother Creer said, well, don't make any trouble, he said. But Brother Dickerson is a nice man, of course. He was my brother, my father-in-law. And I couldn't say any different. Then I went on and said, for them to write a letter like that, and knowing what the charges, the scriptural charges against an unfaithful servant are, to call a man an unfaithful servant and mark it with red ink.
Who were they to call?
The Watchtower. I said, they should take all their files and their printing machines and their officers and throw them in the middle of the Atlantic before they should do anything like that. Hurt a man's feelings. Brother Rada turns to Brother Mason, he says, are your feelings hurt, George? George went like this. No, but my feelings are not hurt, to be crying like a baby. So then they had testimony meeting, and one after the other said, well, if you feel like Brother Colin, if you won't come to meetings anymore. So I took their saying and stayed away from meetings after that. That's the Watchtower for you.
The Watchtower Bible and Tract Society.
Oh, yes.
Excuse me, please.
passage from the Gospels. The Lord said, talking to his disciples, come ye apart with me and rest a while. And what his theme was that we should rest a while. I tried to follow that up. I found a commentary of the Bible that synchronized the Lord's experiences. When I came to that, and you know what I found? The Lord was speaking on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, and he and his disciples were so long at it that he was tired, dead tired. So he told them that, and he got on the boat and crossed the lake. By the time he got across the lake on a boat, the mob that circled the lake and were waiting for him on the other side. So he started to preach again. Don't forget now, he asked them to come apart to rest a while. So he taught again all afternoon. And towards evening, they realized that the people were hungry and they needed something to eat. He got the, what was it, 2 loaves of 5 fishes or 5 loaves of 2 fishes, I forget it was. And he took that and blessed them and broke them and served 5,000 people. His disciples were crossing the sea again, the lake, and they were in trouble. It was a storm. So when he came down off the mountain, they were floundering. So he walked on the water to save them. That's my Lord. Not a moment of rest. Not a moment of rest. We take the Apostle Paul, another example, and I can't find him anywhere but talking, preaching. And I find him saying, woe is me by preaching. Come to the reformers. One of my heroes is Wycliffe. He and his people, so was Waldo. All those people were itinerary preachers, all of them. They had their properties confiscated. We don't know what persecution is. Paraphrasing, you haven't shed any blood yet, and I haven't shed any blood, neither has anybody that I know of. Perhaps they don't do it that way anymore, but unless we are active in the Lord service, nobody will bother us, nobody cares. Today the biggest drawback or the biggest hindrance to the church is they don't care. Whatever it is. You teach what you want, let the other fellow teach what he wants, but you let me alone. That's the general attitude. But the early Christians, the Waldenses, they preached, and they were jailed, and they had the properties confiscated. And Waldo used his wealth to keep his people from working with him alive. Wycliffe was similar in the same way. He was from Houston or San Antonio and then over to Bob. They divided on the train on the way. The Russell states it this way, again, my paraphrase. There are three things, he said, that will be the test of every individual at the end of the age. Faith, hope, and zeal. Then he asked any comment, anybody, and nobody said anything, so no, I said, I have something to say. I said, he asked me to say what I had to say. I said, the rest of you don't travel very far.
what I do. And in my situation among the world people, I find that as far as faith is concerned, sticking very closely to the truth. As far as love is concerned, I said, wherever I go, none of that is lacking. But as far as zeal is concerned, but elsewhere and here, we are very, very short. That was told the apostles in the earth and to me or anybody else here. So the brother asked again, he said, any other comments? I volunteered again. I said, I don't know whether this passage, anybody is involved in this passage, but I am. Whatever the Lord ordered his disciples to do, he ordered me to do. Whatever he promised his disciples, anticipation of a reward in the future, I said, the same thing is offered to me. So whether anybody else would claim this as being his orders from the Lord, it's immaterial to me, but the Lord is addressing me. Honest enough to say that the friends are more interested in reproducing than reproducing. They reproduce their own kind rather than as humans by having children than reproducing Christians after their kind. We hear that a brother or a sister or a man that we're working with got hurt in his own heart. And suddenly we get the idea that we should go and see him. But that's the working of the Spirit. We sacrifice anything that we're doing, and the Spirit moves us to go to the hospital. We never thought of it before. It just occurred to us that we ought to go. Many times I say to Martha, let's go see so-and-so. There's these things happen. And Martha has two, three excuses why we should. Well, I insist, if you're not going, I'm going. If you want to go with me, all right. And we go, and lo and behold, it was a need, a necessity that we should go. Somebody should go. Now that you're removed by the Lord's Spirit. Not that the Holy Spirit, a part of it, came and got into my heart, or whatever you think it gets into, but God's influence was exercised in my mind and in my heart to stop everything I was doing to go and do this particular job.
Thank you.
The work of the Spirit.
Thank you, Brother. Brother, now after the 5 years then you mentioned, do you think that, I think Brother Peter has really explained it to in a very good manner. The Spirit then is the influence, is the power of God. It's not a being or something separate from God.
You see, this
is the voice that you heard.
I think when we get down to our second paragraph, reading it might help.
Yes, I'm just thank you for the voice.
The word pneuma is a Greek word and is not used in the Old Testament. We're never used in the Old Testament. If you find the word pneuma in the Old Testament, then I'm a Turk.
Yeah. Right. We have to realize that everything is from one end of the Bible to the other, not a few verses in Genesis. To understand that Genesis, let us make man, we have to read John. And John says that all things were made by the Michael, the first begotten of the Lord. So we have to accept that the us refers to Michael, and Jesus in his pre-human existence, not to some vague spirit. But it does say, the Spirit of the Lord moved on the waters. the power of the Lord moved on the waters. And the Spirit of the Lord moved on the prophets, that they should write what they didn't understand. So the Lord's Spirit has been used in different ways throughout the ages, and we must accept what each age gives forth and the use of the Spirit in that age to mix them. Can he speak of heavenly things to an earthly man? If he could understand it, it would be like him. And the whole third chapter of John is on that. But we have to use the whole Bible, not individual scriptures. And that is being filled with the Spirit and following through with what the Lord has given us.
Get wisdom. But with the getting of wisdom, get understanding. And we cannot without the Holy
Spirit.
That the Holy Spirit of God move with just a something on the face of the waters, and they produce it. It isn't a matter that the Holy Spirit is the third person of God, the factory that went down to the sea and manufactured fish and eels and clams and oysters, but God's influence was exercised and it produced a nature, a station that's beyond us, we can't understand. That's what the Lord told to Nicodemus. If you can't understand simple natural events, how can you understand what I'm talking about? Not why, what Jesus talked about. It's a matter of coming down. And in fact, many times I told people that I talk to, you have to forget everything you learned in the Catholic and in the Baptist Church, because they are based on error. The basic beliefs of Catholicism and Baptism is error. You have to forget everything you learned if you want to know the truth. You have a sister in a meeting on a Thursday afternoon at Sister Jackson's. We were talking about simple things like this, and she asked me, how about Revelation 12? I said, sister, let's go to Genesis and find out what Genesis said. Someday maybe we'll get to Revelation. And I think we're pirate friends. But that's, we try to understand Revelation when we didn't understand the first verse of Genesis yet.
Thank you.
Getting too grim. At least I have been. They're leading a meeting in New York in an apartment way up in Metropolitan Insurance Company's buildings. And it was a Greek sister who spoke broken English. And we came to this passage about the broken vessels. And in translating it from Greek to English, the way it come out from her says, we are cracked pots. Another one was a Russian working with the same idea. It come out something like this. The spirit was willing, but the flesh was weak. It come out something like this. The vodka was wonderful, but the rose, too tough. Now it's according what language you're talking, according to what you have in your mind, as of how you're interpreting. And that's the reason we have so many divisions in Christianity. They don't understand each other. They don't speak the same language. They don't say the same thing.
I try to talk them into being first on this side, but they don't see it. I have been so delighted to be at this convention. It was sort of nip and tuck, two elbows, and an eye operation. We couldn't decide till the 21st of the month whether we could come or not, and then we had to get plane tickets. Before I begin on my own ideas, I want to say that the
Armstrongs and the McDonalds and the Vinsons, all the young people in our class sent their love and greetings to all who know them. They're doing very well and very earnest to do the Lord's will. Also, our members from Philadelphia that come down every Sunday, Sister Vera and her sister, and Sister Margaret Hedman, which I'm sure you all know. Sister Vera had her plane reservations, and then they couldn't come, which bothered her a lot. You know how much she loves conventions. But she's not too able to travel anymore. I have been brought up in the truth. I'm 76 years old, but like lots of you here, I was brought up in the truth. My father got the truth in 1900, and it came up over the period of Brother Russell's last heavy work and the discussions and problems of 1914, the photodrama work, and all that is fixed in my mind and heart. We at home had the for this cause in the spring, and it was while we were coming home from a follow-up session in Middletown, in Delaware City, that I got real anxious to get down some steps and went over on my elbow. But you know, the wealth of the sympathy and of the friends, and I kept thinking, well, the Bible Students Grapevine certainly does work. And I kept getting more and more and wider apart and clear to the West Coast, and I thought, how can it be? How can it be? And then I got the newsletter. Along with the newsletter, I got a card from Brother and Sister Hormisch in Germany. And I thought, there's something odd about this. So I looked in the newsletter. I don't know who put it in, but I certainly appreciated all the wonderful messages that were sent. And I ask in interest in your prayers that the Lord may grant us other opportunities to witness to his name. We have run into from, in our follow-up, a lot of charismatic Catholics. And they aren't satisfied with the teachings. They're delighted to be shown how the Bible fits together. We put out whole sets of volumes, and about the third time we visited one place, we were even planning a meeting in Middletown, had everybody all excited about it. And she said, you know, we're going to a charismatic meeting on Tuesday nights, and if I could get the power of speaking with tongues, I wouldn't want to be cheated out of it. So you better not come till I find out if I'm going to get this power. And having the same experience in Delaware City, we felt kind of sat on, but we'll still go ahead and finish the follow-up as fast as we can. It's long drawn out because the people are so scattered. We got about 160 returns. But they're all over the county and down into Maryland. Takes a little doing to find them all. I have loved the truth for many years, and I feel that it is still the same. And if we hold fast to the volumes and the tabernacle shadows, we won't get out on a limb and be misguided. And I ask an interest in your prayers and your interest in holding fast until the Lord says, well done. For me, until the ancient worthies appear.
Thank you, Sister Carloman. I think there were great lessons in your testimony, not the least of which, why would we want to learn to speak in tongues when we have the kind of a communication system that the Bible students do. That makes the Bell telephone system appear that it was created by Mickey Mouse at times. Thank you again, Sister Coleman. You have been a great, you and Brother Peter have been a great source of encouragement to others. We have very much appreciated your efforts and your work, and I'm sure that some of us, at least all of us perhaps, have been persuaded that we should be out on the streets and doing a little more than what we're doing from time to time, to view things a little more urgently perhaps than what we have been inclined to do. Again, we thank you very much, and I'm sure that the brethren join me in saying that we are pleased and delighted that you and Brother Peter could be here. It was a true blessing to us. Now, who will be next?
The Lord bless you. Brother Coleman, would you like to be next?
This is Brother Peter Coleman from the Wilmington, Delaware Ecclesia. I understand I can't hear very well and I can't see very well. You'll have to excuse me. And sometimes I'm charged with being long-winded. I'll try to be as short-winded as I possibly can. But it's a long life and a long experience in the truth. And I understand that the subject of our testimony today is what doctrines have done in my life. Is that correct? Is that it? They tell me that that's correct. I started to attend meetings way back in 1918. I'm not the oldest brother in the truth. I know that there are others in the audience that are older in the truth than I am. But my life and my experiences in the truth have been different than many others. The first talk that I heard was by a brother Zook. I never saw him since, and I never heard about him since. His first subject, There Is in the Morning, we used to have in 1918, a visiting speaker had the morning talk for the friends and the afternoon talk for the public. The first talk I heard was for the friends, and it was about the love of God. That talk captured me. There was no turning away, there is no turning back, but an appreciation of the love of God. I started to attend meetings, and we had a Friday night meeting in Reading, Pennsylvania, and the leader of that meeting was a brother Stanley Young. He somehow or other, for some reason or other, asked me to read Galatians 3:8. I read it, and I remember it. God, foreseeing that he would justify the heathen through faith, preached the gospel before him unto Abraham, saying, In thee shall all nations be blessed. He said, Now what do you get from that? I said, There is nothing else to get except that God foresaw that He, God, would justify the heathen through faith and preach the gospel beforehand to Abraham, and the gospel was that he would bless all the families of the earth. He said, That's beautiful. He says, Read the 16th verse. So I read the 16th, and the 16th read that God did not say to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, and thy seed is Christ. That seed is Christ. What do you get from that? I said, Well, there's nothing else to get, but that the seed of Abraham that would bless all the families of the earth is Christ. He says, That's right. Will you go to the end of the chapter? I forget now, I think it's the 23rd, maybe the 24th verse to the end. That passage reads, as many of you as have grown, as have accepted Christ, it's not exactly those words, have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, neither male nor female, there is no bond of free, for all of you are one in Christ Jesus. And if you be Christ's, then you are Abraham's seed and heir to the promise. I jumped off my seat. The first time that this doctrine came to my mind or came to my heart. If you are Christ's, if you belong to Christ, then you are the seed of Abraham through whom God would bless all the families of the earth. That broke up the meeting. I've never been the same since. I don't expect and I hope I never change. I went to work for the Watchtower for a few months. I moved to Wilmington to get a job. I co-portured out of Wilmington for a full year. In co-portering, we established two classes. In serving in Wilmington, eventually I was elected an elder and I served the Wilmington class up to 1927. That is the Watchtower class. In 1927, we went to Toronto to a Bible Students Convention. There, I got shocked and disturbed, and I found out that I wasn't the only one, but there were thousands of others. We went back to Wilmington, and gradually, by 1929, we had to leave the class because of what the society was preaching and practicing and changing. I worked with the Harp of God. I canvassed with it. By that time, I was made service director in Wilmington. I directed the work and replaced quite a number of harps, and we established groups. Some people came in the truth at the time. That was 1929. We were out of the class then. We wandered around doing nothing. Just having a good time, going to a theater there, having dinner over there, going visiting this garden, going to something else for, probably a full year, maybe a little more. Then we got other friends together and we organized the class that's a going concern today. We're asked to go to the classes in New York. The class in New York was organized. The Dawn was started. And after I was elected a trustee of the Dawn, among others, and I was asked to leave my job in Wilmington, rent my house, and my wife and I go to work for the Dawn. We did. Before that, I'm sorry. While we were in Wilmington, in about 1932-33, a friend came to us and asked us to use our home as a basis of making the Frank and Ernest programs. We finished our attic into a studio, and the Frank and Ernest programs, I was making the original record, the first record, and Sister Coleman used to play that record and copy it sometimes as many as 30 times, to send to 30 different stations. We did that for 10 years. Then we were asked to rent the house and go to work for the Dawn. We did. We made the records down there for 5 more years. We worked there for 5 more years. After that, we went back to Wilmington, and we started to work in Wilmington, and the class has been organized and gradually grew until we numbered near 60, 65 persons in the class. That's what the doctrines that I first learned in Reading, Pennsylvania, the inspiration that we are the Christ, the seed of Abraham that will bless all the families of the earth. And my life, and the Lord gave me a partner who was a co-preacher at the time that we get married or previous to that, and she has been a very loyal and faithful and cooperative sister that anybody could ever ask from the Lord. That's been my life. All my talks, I traveled all over the country. I have friends all over the country and in Canada. I don't think I hurt anybody. I never intended to. Most of my talks are on activity. Many friends, some of the friends think you are pushing us, you are goading us. I never goaded anybody, never intended. What my intentions have been is to contaminate others, to bring others to the situation that I am in, that I've been in ever since 1918. Total devotion to the Lord. And asking the Lord, Lord, what will you have me to do? We can't get in the kingdom, dear friends, on a sled. We can't slide in. We can't do any way. We can't sneak in. We have to labor, to work, to get in. I'm convinced of that. I practice that. And I'm trying to get my brethren, my sisters, to imitate. There is a passage of scripture that comes to my mind lately. John the Baptist was about to be executed. He was in jail. And he sent his disciples to the Lord. You all remember the occasion. And John is asking the Lord, are you the one or are we starting to look for another? And the Lord sent a message back. The message was this. You go back to John and tell him what you see and hear. Tell them that the lepers are cleansed, the blind see, the dead are raised from the dead, and this is the important thing, that the gospel is being preached to the poor. That's the important thing, dear friends. That's what the Lord is asking us to do. And the joy and the happiness of the Lord go along with our obedience. I'm pleading with our young people, so many young people, to devote their time. And I urge the parents to help their children to get into the work, some kind of work, the work of the Lord. And the Lord will bless them, make them as happy as I and my wife have been all these many years. I'm sorry to have talked too much to friends too long, but it was in my heart. I can't keep it. We are lacking. The kingdom seems to be delayed, and the prophet tells us that. It seems to tarry, and it's our fault. We haven't finished the harvest of the gospel age. Let this convention be the turning point. Let's go back to work. Let's do what what we can, what our hands find to do. And the Lord will bless us and take us home. Pray for me that I may go home soon.
Thank you, Brother Coleman, for your 61 years of appreciation.
Yes, Brother.
This tape of reminiscences and class comments by Brother Peter Coleman was compiled from a series of recordings made mainly during 1976 in Wilmington, Delaware. We hope they have been inspiring, humorous, and informative. Some of the stories were told around Brother and Sister Jackson's dining room table after some Monday night meetings. Others were told in the Coleman's attic while folding tracts. The class comments were recorded during various meetings in Wilmington. Sister Mercer's and Brother Peter's testimonies were given during the Indiana-Ohio Convention of about 1979. Another tape, an oral history interview of Brother Peter Coleman, is also available.